Okay, thank you. Let me skip first the usual introductory part of Thank the Organizers due to obvious reasons. So the related parameters which are specified in this title and which I'll be talking about are the set of function of flowers and vector chromatic numbers. I will define both of these quantities and I will try to indicate why they are related to eigenvalues. So the eigenvalues have been used and have been defined in several talks, but let me do it still briefly. So suppose we have a graph on n vertices, then we'll define a matrix which is called the adjacency matrix of G, which is n by n matrix of zeros and ones, where you put one if I and J are connected by an edge, and you put zero otherwise. So what you get is a zero-one symmetric matrix. For example, for this five cycle, you'll get this 5 by 5 matrix of zeros and ones. Now, the most important properties from combinatorial point of view of those matrices is such a matrix is a real symmetric matrix, and therefore it has n real eigenvalues, which I will denote by lambda 1 up to lambda n, and it's conventional to sort them in the non-increasing order. So lambda 1 is at least as large as lambda 2, and so on. And the other thing is a orthonormal basis of Rn composed of eigenvectors of G. So I will denote the eigenvectors by V1 up to Vn, the basis is B, and A times Vi is lambda I times Vi. So those are the real things. So let me mention briefly some properties of eigenvalues. There are many of them, but I will mention just some, and some of them I will use later in the talk. First of all, if the maximum degree of a graph is denoted by delta, then all eigenvalues are at most delta in their absolute values. And moreover, if a graph is D-regular, then we know actually that the first eigenvalue is exactly D. And the first eigenvector is the constant vector. And all other eigenvalues, all eigenvalues actually, are sitting in the interval minus D. And moreover, as I mentioned, for example, a graph G is connected if and only if all eigenvalues are strictly less than D, and the graph G is non-bipartite if all eigenvalues, actually the last one, is strictly larger than minus D. So already here you see some connection between eigenvalues and important graph theoretic parameters. So that's the most usual matrix you use, but sometimes you prefer to use Laplacian, which is defined as follows. You first take the diagonal matrix, which is formed by taking the degrees on the diagonal, D1 up to Dn, and then L, the Laplacian of the graph, will be D minus A. And it's quite easy to figure out that if you take an n-dimensional vector x and the product x transpose lx is this summation of quadratic terms, and it's therefore non-negative. So this shows you that Laplacian is always non-negative, and moreover, you have a non-trivial eigenvector in the kernel of this matrix, which is a constant eigenvector. And basically, when looking at the Laplacian, what matters is how small is the smallest non-trivial eigenvalue. Okay. So that's about eigenvalues, and now let me define the third function of flowers. So this was defined in really remarkable paper of last year from 79, which is called the Schoening capacitor of a graph, and formally, the main result of the paper is that some specific parameter which is called the Schoening capacitor of the graph of C5, this simple graph on 5 vertices, is square root of 5. And this is a really remarkable result that somewhat really striking, because there are not so many questions about the graph on 5 vertices which you can pose and which are still untrivial. But from our point of view, what's important is not this result, but rather the definition of the theta function and its connection with other parameters. So I will give two definitions, and actually Lovett's paper has much more of them, and the basic definition of the paper is rather geometric than algebraic, but all of them are shown to be equivalent. So the first definition I will use is the following one. So suppose I have a graph on n vertices labeled 1 up to n. So the theta function of G is defined as the minimal possible first eigenvalue of a matrix, which is n by n matrix, which is symmetric. It obviously should be related by the graph, and the relation is as follows. If the h I j is missing in the graph, then you are forced to put 1 in this matrix. So that's some quantity related to eigenvalues, and let's see what the relation between the theta function. Questions? You look over all symmetric matrices, and the restrictions, whenever you don't see an H, you are forced to put 1. Yeah, and in the other entries, you are free to choose whatever you want. Okay, so No, it's any real matrix. So the only restriction you should put one where you don't see an H, and all other entries you could put any real number. So let's see how it's related to the independence number. And the relation is very simple yet quite powerful for many applications. What you can prove and what actually can be easily proven, the proof is on the slide, that the tether function of the graph is at least as large as the independence number, which is not by alpha of G. And the independence number of a graph is the largest set, size of the largest set, which spans no edges at all, usually. So let's see why is it so. So suppose you have an independent set of size k, and without loss of restriction, and I assume that it's on the first k vertices. Then, if you are trying to find a matrix which satisfies this restriction, you are forced to put ones everywhere in this corner. Yes? And therefore, you get a submatrix of size k by k, which is full of ones, and therefore, the first eigenvalue of matrix A is at least as large as the first eigenvalue of this submatrix, which is k, and therefore, the theta function of G is at least as large as k. So we get rather trivial that the theta function is an upper bound for the independence number of the graph. So here's an alternative definition, again algebraic, and we'll see the purpose of this definition soon. So you can define the theta function of G as this time maximum of sum of the entries of the matrix, and the restriction is as follows. Whenever you see an H and not a non-H in the previous definition, let me maybe put it here. So now whenever you see an H, you are forced to put 0 and not 1. That's just a different kind of restriction, and now you need to normalize it. So you recognize that the trace of B will be 1, and your matrix should be positive semi-definite, and it should be obviously of size n by n. And the importance of this definition has been revealed like 10 years after the paper. This definition allows to claim that this parameter of a graph, as opposed to the, apparently opposed to the independence number of a graph, this parameter can be computed in polynomial time. So why is it so? If you look at this, and if you know the notion of a semi-definite program, so this exactly fits the notion of semi-definite program. In semi-definite programming, you formulate an optimization problem for a matrix which should be semi-definite, which should be positive semi-definite. And this is exactly what we have here, and therefore this parameter can be computed in polynomial time by using the ellipsoid method. And this is a result of Grotschel, Lovish, and Scriver. One thing you should be a bit careful here, because actually, as opposed to the independence number, we're talking here about some real parameters. So computing means actually approximating without any given degree of precision. And you can do it in polynomial time. Okay, and now let me indicate maybe one more connection to the eigenvalues. So if a graph is deregular, as usual in this eigenvalue business, when a graph is regular, the picture is much, much simpler and clearer. So if a graph is deregular, then you can get an upper bound on theta in terms of eigenvalues. So what you get is minus n lambda n divided by minus lambda n. So you shouldn't be really puzzled by this minus there. This bound you're getting is not negative, but positive, because the smallest eigenvalue lambda n is negative, actually. So the bound you get here is some positive number. And moreover, you get an equality if G is H-transitive, which means that you can, for every pair of edges, there is an automorphism of a graph which moves every edge to every other edge. And, for example, from this result, you can derive the value of the theta function, not only of the graph C5, but of every cycle you get this. So this second parameter we'll be using, I will be talking about, and now let me introduce the third parameter. So the third parameter is the so-called vector chromatic number, which was introduced by Karger, Motwani, and Sudan in the conference paper in 1994, and the journal version of the paper appeared in 1998. So their motivation was to develop algorithms for approximate graph coloring. So let me define you first the definition of a usual coloring. So suppose we have a graph G, so we'll say that this graph is k-colorable if there exists a coloring function f, which colors all verses of the graph in colors 1 up to k, labels verses by numbers 1 up to k, in such a way that whenever we have an h, I, j, the color of I should be distinct from the color of j. And the chromatic number of a graph, which is usually known by k of j, is the minimal k for which the graph is k-colorable. So that's the usual definition. So let's try to mimic the definition, but instead of labeling vertices by numbers, by colors, we rather label vertices by vectors. So now we call graph G vector k-colorable if the following holds. You need to find a bunch of unit vectors v1 up to vn in Euclidean space of some dimension. The dimension is not really important. You can think about it as n, but it can be actually lower. So you need to find a bunch of unit vectors in such a way that whenever you see an h, the angle between corresponding vectors should be large, which means that the scalar product of vi with j should be at most minus 1 over k minus 1. So let's see how it works. Let's take a very simple example of the triangle, a graph on three vertices. So again, what do we need to find? We need to find a bunch of three vectors in such a way all vertices are connected to each other. And therefore, what we need is to find three vectors so as to maximize all angles between those vectors. So the most natural solution is what's depicted here. You can embed those vectors in R2, and you just make all angles to be equal and to be 2 pi over 3, and therefore the scalar product will be minus 1 half. So minus 1 half should be equal to minus 1 over k minus 1, and therefore what you get is that this graph G is 3 vector colorable. So the, in this particular case, we know that the chromatic number is 3, and what we get is that the vector chromatic number is at most 3, actually. Okay. Now, in order to make sense of this parameter, we need actually two things. First, we need to somehow to relate it to the usual chromatic number, and second, we need to say something about its computational features. So first of all, we define it. So the vector chromatic number will be the minimal k for which g is vector k-colorable, as opposed to usual chromatic number where this k is integer. Here, this parameter can be a real number. Okay, so that's the definition. Now, let's compare the usual chromatic number and the vector chromatic number, and it's pretty easy, also very important result. So it's based on the following proposition. You can find k vectors in Rk minus 1 so that the angles between those vectors are as large as possible. All of them are equal to minus 1 over k minus 1. And this is a simple exercise in linear algebra or in induction, for example. They did it by induction. So given this, it's fairly easy to see that the vector chromatic number of the graph is at most the chromatic number. Why is it so? Suppose we have a graph whose chromatic number is k, so we take its proper coloring, c1 up to ck, and what we'll do, we need to assign vectors to vertices. So what we do, we take the vertices from the first group, from the first color c1, and assign to all of them vector u1. We take vertices from the color c2 and assign to all of them vector u2, and so on, to ck, uk. Actually, I forgot to mention here that those vectors are unit vectors. And now, the only thing you need to verify is that the angle between vectors corresponding to vertices of an h is satisfies this quantity. But if you have an h goes between two color classes, and therefore you take a product between ui and uj for different i and j, and therefore the product based on this proposition is minus 1 over k minus 1. And that's the reason they put this particular function here. So from this we know that the vector chromatic number is at most the usual chromatic number, and sometimes actually it can be less. So the other relation they showed in their paper is which can appear quite surprising at the first sight, is that actually the vector chromatic number can be related to the set of function, not of the graph itself, but rather of its complement. Complement of a graph is formed by making non-edges into edges and making edges into non-edges. So what they prove is that the vector chromatic number is at most the theta function of the complement of the graph. And actually, if you go back to the definition of the vector chromatic number, instead of requiring that all angles are at most something, you require at least something, you require that all angles are exactly some particular quantity, you get the equality. And therefore, those two parameters, which is defined in a very different way, the one is defined completely geometrically, for example, vector chromatic number is something about vectors, and the way at least I define the theta function here is completely algebraic, those two are very, very much related to each other. Questions?
If you take an equal value, don't receive equality with chromatic number, no?
Well, k equal 1 is the degenerate case, so think about a larger k.
It's not necessarily equal,
and unfortunately, it's not necessarily equal, because otherwise you would get very good approximation of the algorithm for the chromatic number, and it's not, so you can build example. I think Gideon was possibly talking about this. You can construct examples of graph where the gap between the usual chromatic number and the vector chromatic number is close to n.
is that presumed, or they're just a unit simplex, a regular simplex?
Not exactly, but you can take a unique simplex and add one more vector. It's pretty easy to construct. Okay. So what's important from my point of view, from the deep learning point of view of this talk, is which algorithmic consequences do we have? So all those parameters I mentioned, the eigenvalues and eigenvectors, they're polynomial computable, and we know this from our college lessons. Tetalog G is polynomial computable because of this semi-definite programming setting. The vector chromatic number of G is also polynomial computable because of the same reason, because you are looking for some positive semi-definite matrix, and you can do this. So we can compute all of these, and as we've seen, those parameters are very much, pretty much related to many other parameters of the graph, and therefore we can hope that if we have this information, we can compute this, we can derive many efficient algorithms which will allow us to approximate or to compute many other important parameters of graphs. And it is so indeed. There are many algorithmic applications of those three things. And what's especially striking in those applications, and if you take some kind of random instances, then you usually get much more successful, much more strong applications than for the general case. Somehow those two things go well together. And I will show several such applications where you indeed use some of those parameters, and your instance is random in some sense, and you'll get a pretty good result, which you cannot get by, apparently cannot get by some other means. So I'll show you some examples, some real number between 2 and 3, depending on my time, where you can use these parameters. So the first one is finding a large hidden clique, and this joint work with Noga and Benny. Okay, so random graph is the usual thing. You take vertices 1 up to n, and you connect a pair of vertices I and j by n h independently in this probability p. And the clique in the graph is a subset in which all pairs are connected by n h. And I denote, as usually, by omega of g is the clique number of the graph, which is the size of a maximal clique in g. Now, what we'll be interested in is the behavior of the clique number and the behavior of cliques in the usual random graph GNP, and in particular, we'll take the value of 1/2, the most important value. It's quite easy to see that the clique number of GN 1/2 behaves asymptotically like 2 log n. And the issue is what can you find in polynomial time? You know that there are such cliques, and the question is, give me an algorithm which will be successful for almost all of the graphs and which you'll find relatively large clique. And the answer, the known answer, is that if you run the greedy algorithm, which basically takes the next vertex and tries to join it to whatever you have already in the clique, if it's joined to every vertex in the clique, and otherwise it skips to the next vertex. So you can take some modification to make it more robust. So the greedy algorithm finds almost surely, and actually this almost surely can convert in a very, very large probability mean, very, very close to 1. So you can find a clique of size about half as large as the clique number. So clique is of size 2 log n. And what you can find in polynomial time, and rather easily actually, is half the size of the clique, which is, I think, quite acceptable by terms of any approximation algorithm. And this is a very old open problem of CARP, which is one of the central problems in algorithmic random graph theory. Can we do better? Is there a polynomial algorithm which finds a clique of size 1 plus epsilon log n for some fixed epsilon for almost all graphs in the probability space gn 1/2? And this problem stands where it stood more or less 25 years from now. There are some partial negative results, some partial positive results, but we still don't know the answer for this problem. And partially because of this and partially because of the importance of this parameter clique number, the following model has been introduced by Jerome in 92, and the notation is gn 1/2 ke. So it goes as follows. So first of all, you generate a usual random graph gn 1/2. Then you take this instance, and on top of it, you add a clique q of size k at random. You find q and k random places, and put the click of size K, and you should think of K as something much, much larger than look and some power of NC. So basically, it goes like for this. So first of all, you expose your random graph. You get some edges, some non-edges. And then on top of it, you put a random click of size K, and you put all edges. You need to find it right in pen first. So you put all edges inside. So what you get inside is the usual random graph general alpha, but on top of it, you impose the click of size K. Now, it's obvious that the click number of this graph is at least as large as K, and actually, if your K is much larger than like N, it's quite easy to prove that...
Is P equals half?
Yeah, P equals half. So you take G in 1/2, you expose each H, you make each H to be an H or non-H with probability 1/2.
In the previous lecture, you, whatever, people teach us that with probability, if P is above 1 over whatever N, log N over N, we already know with almost surely that we have click of order...
No, it was about connectivity. So,
and it does not become click very quick.
Yeah, what we people know about this problem is this statement on the previous slide, that the click number will be about 2 log n. Okay. For p equals 1/2. Well, it's
okay. Yeah.
Okay, so typically the click is of size 2 log n, and so now on top of it, you impose a click of size k, and this click will be unique. So the click number will be k, and this will be the unique largest click. And you can ask the same kind of computational question. First of all, the ultimate task is to recover the largest click. So here's some random procedure which generates a random instance. Then your algorithm accepts it and looks inside and tries to find this click, or you can be more modest and say that instead of finding the whole click, you will be satisfied by finding a click of size 1 plus epsilon log n, and making some progress as opposed to the usual situation of g n 1/2. So that's the problem, and somehow it's quite surprising. It turns out that the boundary between something very easy and something relatively not trivial is very narrow. Actually, it's measured in logarithmic factors. So if you take your k to be something like square root n log n, then it's quite easy to find the click, this hidden click, because Kuchera notes in 95 that almost surely in this situation, for every vertex in the click and for every vertex outside the click, the degree in the click will be strictly larger than the degree outside the click. And this is natural, because if you add click, you add some edges, and therefore you increase degree. And if this situation indeed, it's quite easy to find the click. What you do, you sort your degrees, you take k largest degrees, and this will be your click. So this is extremely easy algorithm which does it. And somehow, if you go a bit below it, the problem already for square root n becomes highly non-trivial, let's say non-trivial, and for k below square root n, we don't know more or less how to do it. So let me describe you the idea of the solution for the case k to be square root of n. So what you'll do, you use spectral techniques to recover this hidden click. Somewhat surprising, because there is nothing related to spectrum of the graph and the formulation of the problem, just some random instance. But on the other hand, it really helps. So let's look first at gn 1/2. For gn 1/2, this graph is almost regular, and therefore its first eigenvalue is very close to the degree, which is n over 2, and the first eigenvector is very close to the constant vector. This follows from almost regularity. Now, what's more important is the result of Fourier decomposition from 81, which has been mentioned, or similar results have been mentioned already yesterday, for example. All other eigenvalues are much smaller in the absolute values, and the largest of them is at most square root of n in the absolute value. So there is a very large gap between the first one and the remaining ones. Now let's see what happens when we add a click. So first of all, the graph still is almost regular. The degree was about n over 2, and the degree is still about n over 2. And moreover, you can show that not much happens with the eigenvalues from number 3 to number n. They are still in this region of the semicircle law. They are still at most square root n in the absolute value. So basically, if you want to use a spectral method, the only hope of you is to look at the second eigenvalue and to try to figure out what's going on here. So again, what can we hope for? So our graph is almost regular, and therefore, if you want to find, if you want to show the second value is large, we need to find a vector which is orthogonal to the vector v1, which means orthogonal to the vector of all one smallest, and such that for the value of the product x transpose ax for this vector should be large. So the natural idea is your clique is dense. So the natural approach would be to put large positive weight on the clique, to put small negative weight outside the clique, and hope for the best. And this is what we do indeed. So we define vectors zi as follows. You put weight n minus k for every vertex in the clique. You put weight minus k for every vertex outside the clique, and this will be your vector. Now, if you normalize it, you can prove that this vector, this normalized vector z divided by norm of z, is quite close, actually, to the second eigenvector. So this was a pretty good shot. And the second eigenvalue will be roughly one half of the clique. And if you make the constant in this square root and large enough, so this second eigenvalue jumps out of the semicircle law region and will become larger than any other eigenvalue. Now, our actual picture is somewhat different because we don't know where the clique is. But what we know to do, what we can do, is to compute eigenvectors and compute eigenvalues. And therefore, the algorithm will do the following thing. So, in some simplified version of it, what we do is just compute the second eigenvector. And then, to prove that most of the mass of it is located on the clique, so if we simplify things a bit, we can say that if you take k largest by absolute value coordinates of p2, you get your clique. Actually, it's not so, but you get most of your clique by looking at the k largest value, and then somehow you can clean up and recover all of the clique. And one thing to be mentioned is that here is another connection between eigenvalues and those related parameters. There is an alternative algorithm by Fege and Krauthammer from 2000, which is based actually on the theta function of the complement of a graph. And what the proof is the following thing. First of all, if you put your clique and your clique is of size square root n, then this theta function of the complement of the graph is exactly k. Moreover, if you delete any vertex from the clique, it drops by 1. On the other hand, if you don't delete a vertex from the clique, but rather delete a vertex outside the clique, it still stays k. And then the algorithm is very simple, because you are able to compute this parameter, theta of g. You can compute it. You can compute it for every vertex. And you can look at g minus v and compute theta function. And if theta function drop, you know that you are inside the clique. If theta function doesn't drop, you know that you are outside the clique. And this will be your algorithm. And actually, the algorithm has one significant advantage. It works in the so-called semi-random model, but unfortunately, I have to skip it. So
can you do epsilon times square root n, or usually 2 times?
You need another trick to make it epsilon square root n, but what you can do roughly, instead of looking at the whole graph, you take a vertex and look at its neighborhood. Okay, or you look at the common neighborhood of several vertices, and this shrinks the size of your subgraph, and your clique stays basically the same. If you pick 10 vertices from the clique, then the common neighborhood still contains a clique of about the same size, but on the other hand, it shrinks by a factor of 2 to the 10. And therefore, you get a reduction, basically, to the previous case. Questions? Okay. So now, because one asked the question, so let me present a joint result with him. So this will be... this will be about approximating the independence number in expected polynomial time. So let me state briefly the picture. So I defined already the independence set and an independence set and the independence number of a graph. So the independence number is the largest independence set. An independence set is set which spans no vertices. And it's known that computing alpha of g is NP-hard. And it's known, we got a certificate from Avi in the morning, more or less to regard ZZPP as equal to P. And therefore, it's probably hopeless to even to approximate the independence number within some reasonable factor. So from any possible point of view, theoretical or practical, this problem is really very hard. On the other hand, picture changes dramatically if you switch to the typical case. The typical case means you take G and P and you look inside. So for G and P, the independence number behaves roughly like log n P divided by P. This one thing. And the other thing is the greedy algorithm, which I described to some version of it, finds an independent set of size roughly one half of the optimal number. So there's a huge contrast, very sharp contrast between the worst case behavior and the typical behavior. And somehow what you can try to do, you can try some to bridge between those two approaches. And you can try to find an algorithm which is successful, not almost always at this gradient algorithm, but rather always, and it takes on average polynomial time, as opposed to this worst-case approach where you need to have polynomial time for all the graphs. And this is what's usually called average-case analysis. So here's a formal definition. So suppose you have some algorithm of graph. Think about algorithm finding an independent set, and the input of the algorithm is a graph analysis. So we measure expected running time as follows. We sum up all possible inputs over all graphs on n vertices, say. And then a typical summand is the probability of a graph G in probability space GNP times the running time of G on A. So you average over running time of your algorithm. And then you say that running time is what you like to get. You like to get an algorithm whose expected running time, this expression, is polynomial. Now, there are several features of this approach. First of all, what we'd like to have, we'd like to have a guaranteed performance for every instance, as opposed to the typical analysis where we are satisfied with performance for almost every instance. That's one thing. The other thing is we'd like to have running time which is polynomial, but polynomial on average, and therefore there may be some instances, and probably there should be some instances for which we should invest much longer time, but those instances are rare. And so if you have exponentially few instances for which you need exponential time, this can still be acceptable. So somehow the main difficulty is to figure out what are those rare instances and how you can separate typical instances from those rare, and then to figure out what you do for typical instances and what you do for those rare and annoying instances. Okay, so now the thing I will be interested in is an approximation algorithm for the independence number of G. So you measure the performance of an approximation algorithm by the so-called approximation ratio, which appears, for example, in the first talk of the day. So the approximation ratio of the algorithm is what is the truth value divided by what your algorithm outputs, and you should go over all possible inputs. For example, if you take graphs on the vertices, and we are talking about the algorithm for approximating the independence number, then the ratio will be the independence number of the graph divided by what you can get by your algorithm, and you take here the worst-case approach. So aim is to find an approximation algorithm for independence number which has good approximation ratio, where good means, for example, better than this n minus n to the power 1 minus epsilon ratio in the hardness result. And you wanted to have expected polynomial running time for various values of p of n. So in principle, it should not necessarily be uniform. For various values of p, you can use various algorithms. And now the result we have is the following. So if your H probability is between 1 over square root n roughly and any constant arbitrary close to 1, then there is such an algorithm which approximates the independence number. Its approximation ratio behaves roughly like square root of NP, you should divide by logarithmic factor, and the expected running time is polynomial on n. And, for example, for the case p equals 1/2, you get here roughly square root n divided by log n, as opposed to n to the power y minus epsilon general hardness result. So what I will try to indicate here is how to do it for p equals 1/2, but a general approach is very, very similar. So for this, I will need the following auxiliary matrix. So suppose we have a graph on n vertices, and we define the following matrix. So it will be n by n matrix. It will be symmetric. And you put 1 where we don't have an h between I and j, and you put minus 1 otherwise. So this is a symmetric matrix. And what one can prove is that the following chain of inequalities, that alpha of g is at most theta of g. This we proved already. And this theta of g is at most lambda 1 of m of g, the first eigenvalue of m of g. And this is because if you go back to this definition of theta function, you see, you just look at this definition and you see that the matrix we defined there satisfies this restriction. And therefore, its eigenvalue should be a lower bound form. Should be an upper bound for the theta function of g. And actually, you can prove directly rather easily that lambda 1 of M is at least as large as alpha of G. So we have some parameter, and this parameter is an upper bound for the independence number, and this is what we need in our algorithm. Okay, now what can be said about this matrix? So this matrix is this is a random symmetric matrix, and minus 1, 1, the expectation of every entry is 0, and therefore you can apply again the result of Fourier decomposition, which says that the expectation of the first eigenvalue of this matrix is about square root n. And now what we need for the proof is the following concentration result. So for every t, and t here can be a function of n, and t will be a function of n actually, this parameter lambda 1 of m is very highly concentrated. The probability that it deviates from its expectation by t is bounded by this exponential expression. Okay, so if you're talking about small deviations, it's not the right value of parameter because the variance is actually smaller than a constant, but for large n t, this is the true estimate. And this you get by applying the Telegrand inequality. So you get this concentration of the first eigenvalue of actually a very general class of matrices, not only this particular matrix. So now here comes the algorithm. So what you do, let's go step by step. First of all, you run the greedy algorithm of G, and I'll denote by int its output. So normally, it should be of size roughly log n. And I said that the greedy algorithm is very, very robust. So it fails to do what it's supposed to do with very, very small probability. So if this happens indeed, and if by chance you get an independent set of size much smaller than what you're supposed to get, which is log n, you go to step three, where you will do something drastic. So the other thing is, now we have some independent set at hand of size log n. Now we need to bound from above the independence number of your graph. And for this, you use this lambda 1 of n. We know that it bounds from above the independence number. We know that normally it should be, because of this result of Fourier decomposition, it should be of order square root n, and we know that it's highly concentrated. The probability that it will go up to 10 times square root n is exponentially smaller than. So if this happens indeed, then we go to step 3, and otherwise we are happy we output this independent set. And here comes step 3, so because actually those two things, because if we ever get here, it happens with so small probabilities, basically we don't care what we do. So for example, we can check all subsets of V exhaustively and just to find the largest independent set and output it. Okay. So let's see why it works. So for this, we need to estimate two parameters, approximation ratio and running time. So approximation ratio, we need to show that we always get within square root n times log n the optimal value. And let's see. So the answer is output either at step 2 or at step 3. If it's output at step 3, we got at hand an independent set of size log n. We know for sure that the independence number is at most lambda 1, which is 10 times square root n. And therefore, the ratio is what we need. We get square root n divided by log n. And if the output is produced here at step 3, then obviously we produce the best possible result, and the approximation ratio is 1. Okay. How much time do I have? Okay. So let me try briefly say something about the other problem. So the other problem is to decide k-colorability in polynomial expected time. So the question is, given a graph, let's say on n vertices, you want to decide whether it's three-colorable or not. And this question is NP-hard, but for a typical case, we know it's quite easy to prove that with very, very high probabilities, probability very close to 1, what you get is a non-k-colorable graph. And therefore, if you look for an algorithm which works for a typical instance, it's very simple. Just without looking at the graph, you can just say that the graph is non-three-colorable. And this is because of this behavior of the chromatic number, you can prove it directly. But we look for something a bit different. We look for an algorithm which decides k-colorability, and we want this algorithm to work for all graphs and not for almost all graphs, and we want its expected running time to be polynomial over GNP for various values of the H probability P. Now, the basic case is, let's say, P equals 1/2 of constant probability, and for this case, let me say briefly, it's actually quite easy. Wilf in 84 showed that the backtrack algorithm, which is some simple enumerative algorithm, takes a constant number of steps to produce an answer. And for example, for the case of k equals 3, in 197 nodes of this graph, you get an answer, which is quite remarkable. So it doesn't depend on the size of the graph. Which is not that surprising, because more it's quite easy. Your graph is very, very dense, and it's quite easy to find an instance of non-circular ability. Now, for sparse graph, situation becomes different, and Bender and Wilf showed that it takes an exponential NLRP time for this backtrack algorithm, and the reason is there are no small instances for non-circular ability. So you need to do something different. And what you can do is the following. So first, the result. Your probability can go as low as C over N, where C depends on K. So if for every fixed K, there is a constant C, which in my proof is exponential, okay, but actually you can reduce it. So that if your probability P of N is larger than C of N, then most of the time your answer will be negative. There is an algorithm for deciding circular ability in expected polynomial time over GNP, and the basic tool is the vector chromatic number. So algorithm is extremely simple, as simple more or less as you can imagine. What you do, you just calculate the vector chromatic number. If the vector chromatic number turns out to be larger than k, then you reject your graph, which means you know for sure that the graph is non-k colorable. And otherwise, you're in a very unfortunate, but very rare situation. You can allow yourself to do whatever you want. For example, you can check all possible k colorings and just figure out exactly for yourself whether the graph is k colorable or not. So what's the idea of the proof? So correctness is more or less obvious, and it's obvious because of the fact that vector chromatic number is upper bounded by the usual chromatic number. So if we know that the vector chromatic number is more than k, then the usual one is also more than k, and we know for sure that the graph is non-k colorable. So let's look at the running time. So running time, computing the vector chromatic number, you can do it in polynomial time because of this semi-definite programming approach. And now what bothers you is this third step, because it obviously requires exponential time, k to the n time roughly. What you need to do, you need to show that the probability of getting to this step, namely the probability of having the vector chromatic number at most k, is very small. And this is what you do here. So you get indeed that if your constant c is large enough, then the probability that the vector chromatic number will be smaller than k is at most k to the power minus n, very, very small, exponentially small, with basis of exponent depending on k. So this is some kind of measure concentration, but as opposed to the concentration of lambda 1, for example, the approach here is different. Instead of looking at a random variable, you rather use its combinatorial properties, and you say that if you have small vector chromatic numbers, then you can find many joint independent sets, and using the result of Karger-Matvani and so on, and then you can estimate the probability of having that many large disjoint independent sets. Let me mention finally another problem, which is related to this. So the problem is basically to extend this algorithm or another algorithm and to decide k-colorability in expected polynomial time for all values of the H probability P of N. So basically we treated the case when with very high probability the answer is no. The other case is if your p is small, if your p is some small constant over n, then the answer is mostly yes, and it's rather easy. What's really hard, apparently, and what's really interesting is to be able to go somewhat close to the threshold for k-colorability, which is whose exact value is unknown, but we have some estimates on it, and it's rather common belief, and which is supported by empirical observations, then if you choose your P of N to be close to the threshold for k-colorability, there are many instances which are hard for many known and many standard algorithms for deciding k-colorability. So it would be desirable to understand whether we can devise such an algorithm which will work something close to this threshold or for this threshold. And as opposed to the case I treated, the situation there will be that you have both negative and positive answer to this probability, which is bounded away from zero, as opposed to the case where I treated, where most of the graphs, absolute most of the graphs, should be rejected, actually. Okay, so let me stop here.